Hi everyone, welcome to the Corporate Chat podcast. Your hosts today are Alexis Beaulieu and myself, Cédric Nadeau. Alexis studies applied mathematics while I study finance, both at McGill University. Special thanks to Red Bull for sponsoring the show. Our guest today is Dominique Delvecchio. Mr. Delvecchio is an associate at Panache Ventures, a leading Canadian pre-seed and seed stage venture capital fund.
He also acquired valuable knowledge through his previous work experience at Angel Investor Network 37 Angels and at leading firms Bell and Canadian National, but also at earlier stage companies Asia and Electrobat. He also graduated from Concordia University with a Bachelor of Commerce and later pursued an MBA at McGill University. In this episode, Mr. Delvecchio shares valuable insight on networking, evaluating venture capital investment opportunities, and many more interesting topics. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Dominique Delvecchio.
Hi, Mr. Delvecchio. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really good, thanks. So to start, I'd love to hear about your background and what led you to ultimately pursue a career in venture capital.
Yeah, so my background is, I always say, sort of non-linear and a little bit atypical. I have experience in like the nonprofit sector, the startup world, and the corporate world, which is kind of interesting. So I started my career when I was doing undergrad. I did a few internships in the nonprofit sector, learned a lot about that. Sat on a board as well of a nonprofit organization based here in Montreal. And then when I did my undergrad, which was in marketing, I was really interested in, you know, I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. So I was never really interested in going to work for like a big bank or like a huge multinational company. Like small businesses were always what attracted me. And so I found it really appealing. It was at the time when like tech startups were really sort of taking off. And yeah, I wanted to find a place in one of them. And, you know, I joined as employee number two. At a very young company called Electrobac that actually came out of HEC Montréal at the time, given a general role of like, you know, responsible for marketing and communications. That role eventually evolved over time into more of like a sales and business development role, selling to kind of large property management companies and things like that. Learned a lot of very valuable skills. Like the thing in startups that, you know, you quickly realize is that you wear multiple hats. You learn a lot of things on the job. Anyhow, did that, moved on to another startup again, similarly in a sort of sales B2B growth kind of role. Led national sales for that product across Canada, and then went into the MBA program at McGill. And during that time, like the MBA program normally does, they sort of steer you towards the world of strategy and consulting and that kind of thing. And so I became interested in that space and wanted to work in corporate strategy. I felt that I would have a lot more impact doing that internally at an organization rather than for one of the big firms, because that way you can go a little bit more deep and build relationships and, you know, learn about that particular industry and how that company operates in a more profound way. And so I did that at, I spent a bit of time at Bell and then I spent a few years at CN Rail, which is Canada's largest railroad and one of the largest companies on the TSX, in their strategy and innovation team. And so there, what was interesting is my role kind of evolved over time from doing, you know, your typical corporate strategy, corp dev, M&A type stuff, to more a mandate around like technological innovation and really like essentially trying to answer the question, like what new technology out there can we bring into the business to create value in what was and is like a fairly legacy business, right? The railroad's been operating the same way as it has for decades. So no easy task. And through that role, learned a ton about different types of tech, applications of that tech across various facets of what was a very big business. And part of my role was around like prioritizing these technology initiatives, building business cases around them. And so really understanding and quantifying the value that a particular piece of technology would have. And so I was overseeing a portfolio of technology projects across CN. From there, like after a few years there, like I felt kind of called back to the startup ecosystem. I grew a little bit tired of corporate politics and kind of the day-to-day in that type of an environment, and really wanted to go back to a place that, you know, was much more fast-paced, much more dynamic. But I knew I didn't want to go work for a startup again. Like, I'd already done that. I wanted a chance to work for many or work with many and really work directly with founders. And that's sort of what led me down the path to discover venture capital. You know, as I pursued that and as I spoke to other folks in the industry and learned more about it, I really realized it was an excellent opportunity for me to leverage and hone a pretty broad skill set that I had developed, like I said, across different types of industries, different types of roles, as essentially a generalist. Like I identified as a generalist, but never knew where that would actually be useful. Turns out venture capital is kind of a place where that's useful in some cases. And so I wound up basically finding my way into the space, first with an organization based out of New York called 37 Angels, and then eventually at Panache Ventures, where I am now.
I'm just curious, you mentioned technologies for CN. How do you implement new technologies into like a railway business?
Yeah, good question. Not easily, that's for sure. The way we kind of approached it was because the railroad and the company is so ingrained in its legacy tech, you know, you can't just, from a change management perspective, you can't just pivot and implement like a new piece of technology and expect everyone to use it and everything to go well. There's a lot of change management strategy required. Part of it also requires kind of upselling this and building buy-in amongst many stakeholders, notably the executive team, who, again, were folks that, you know, naturally like have been operating their divisions in the same way they have for a long time. So, you know, they were open to new ideas, but like in some cases, maybe hesitant, you know, to just roll things out at scale. So often what we would do is basically, if there was a really like a particular type of tech that we thought could really add value, we'd build a business case around it. We'd sell that first as an idea. Then from there, we'd build a proof of concept. And so we'd bring in sometimes it was a startup, sometimes it was like a consulting firm, sometimes it was some other, you know, larger tech company that could help facilitate an example of what this kind of technology would bring. We'd structure a small proof of concept that was really confined in scope. We test it out, we develop metrics and like evaluate the impact that it had on the business and the business case that was initially constructed. So we'd have to prove out the value, and then we'd basically represent that back to the executive. And essentially that's when we would make an ask for a larger sort of CapEx funding from the company to essentially roll this out at scale across the business.
And are there any of these projects you found particularly interesting?
For sure. We were doing a lot of really interesting things. One of the ones that I was pretty deeply involved with and ended up sort of managing for a period of time was a digital twin project. So the idea here was basically use algorithmic models to kind of replicate what the operations of a railroad look like, and be able to use that as a simulation tool to run essentially like what if scenarios for different types of operational events, right? So like if we could recreate like a digital duplicate in virtual space of the railroad and all its intricacies, its network, how the trains move, like the meet pass logic that trains use when they like are on the same line and need to make way for each other, all of the constraints around like availability of crews and fuel and where trains need to stop for those particular things and so on and so forth, costs obviously related to all this. We can basically run different scenarios, things like, you know, on the operational side, okay, what if we choose to run shorter trains instead of longer trains? What does that do to our operational metrics, you know? And on the more kind of strategic and sort of longer term horizon side, you know, be able to answer questions like, okay, well, if we were to build new track or double track in a particular stretch of our rail network, what does that unlock in terms of nameplate capacity? And what does that basically, how does that expand our operational throughput as a network, you know? And then you can kind of more easily do an ROI calculation on, okay, well, it's going to cost so many millions of dollars to build out this extra piece of rail. Like, are we getting the kind of benefit out of it that we would expect? Is it worth it? And you can run, you know, different options and different scenarios against one another. So it became a very helpful tool. Now, obviously, as you can imagine, building something like this is not quick and not easy. And so it's done over multiple phases, over multiple years. And so I'm not sure. I imagine the project is probably still ongoing. But yeah, that was really one that I thought was particularly interesting, because it was something that when we had looked into it originally, no other railway were doing, no one had really attempted to do because of the sheer sort of complexity of it.
That's really interesting. It's really surprising how you can optimize a railway with technology that much. So you've said after your sales job, you went to do the MBA, and you've also mentioned how the MBA influenced you to go into consulting or more, let's say, traditional roles. How would you say it impacted you on a more personal level?
Yeah, for me, when I entered the MBA program, I was at a point where, you know, I had worked for a couple different startups, and I was always focused on the commercial side of things. And part of the reason for doing the MBA is that I didn't know what I wanted to do in terms of like the future of my career, but I knew I wanted to sort of expand my horizons, both in terms of like, what types of industries, you know, might be an interest to me, what types of roles might be an interest to me. And specifically, I wanted to learn more about other aspects of business, right? Like HR strategy, operations, finance, things that I hadn't had a chance to really touch on until that point in my career. And so one of the valuable aspects of the MBA for me was the ability to do just that. Like the curriculum structured in a way where it touches a little bit on everything. And because it's done in a sort of applied way through like example use cases from businesses across different types of sectors and different in size, it's a sort of a good lens into like how to solve holistic business problems in a variety of different ways, you know. The other thing I would say is that, so in that way, it opened my eyes to like a world of possibilities now of like, where could I see myself, right? And I learned a whole bunch of new things that I hadn't known prior to that. But the other thing too is just like the network of people that it opened the door to was really important. Like until that point, I only knew folks within like my, you know, circles around what it is I was doing, as most people, right? But it unlocked a whole network of folks, both like students in the same cohort as me, alumni, some of whom like I still keep in touch with today. And it really sort of teaches you the value of, you know, what a strong network can bring. It teaches you skills of how to network effectively with people. And those are all skills that I carry with me today, because especially in venture, it's really a relationship-based business. And so, you know, your value as a venture capitalist largely lies with the strength of your network and what kind of referrals and introductions you can do. It's a big piece of how you can be valuable to a startup company. It's also a big way to access deal flow and things like that. So, Yeah, I still tap into some of this network on a regular basis, whether it's for introductions to companies I want to meet, whether it's for expert opinion on subject areas that I'm looking into at that point in time, like for due diligence and that sort of thing. You never know, in the end, you never really know when someone or some part of your network might actually be useful. And that's why it's so hugely important to really put in the time and effort to build and nurture your network. And that's something that the MBA program really emphasizes quite a bit.
And would you have any tips for any of the members of our audience in regards to networking?
One tip I always say is like, don't just ping people and be like, hey, like, I'd like to meet you and like, let's have coffee kind of thing. Because people, especially in roles like the one I'm in, you get a lot of that, and it's just impossible to like meet those kinds of requests. What I think is much more effective is finding a way to bring some amount of value to that conversation. Like, it's understood that if you're the one reaching out, you're the one trying to learn in that situation. But ultimately, your goal, regardless whether it's trying to find a job or trying to fundraise for your startup or trying to, whatever, right, recruit someone, regardless what the end goal is at the end of the day, the goal of the conversation should just be to walk away with that, with you having left like a meaningful impression with that person, just so that the next time that topic comes up, they'll think of you, right? They'll think of you for that job, they'll think of you for that opportunity, what have you. And so, yeah, finding a way to bring some kind of value in the exchange, even as a student, is meaningful. And there's definitely ways that you can do that, right? So I'll give you an example. We have in venture, it's a very, like, venture capital is an industry where like there's a lot of interest. A lot of people want to work in VC because it's a very exciting space and there's a lot of new stuff going on and so forth. So people that are in these kinds of roles will often receive, like, I'll get every week maybe a dozen requests on LinkedIn from different students or people being like, hey, like, I'm interested in venture capital, would love to speak with you, Now, I don't always have the time to speak to all of them. I try and make time to speak to some. But then, in some of those conversations, some people are just like, hey, what's your job like? I'll answer, but that doesn't, like, I don't get very much from that conversation. But if someone starts asking questions around like, what do you think about this sector? And what do you think about sector? And actually, I read about this. And here's a company that I read about that I think is really interesting. And here's why, I might walk away from that conversation having learned something, or at the very least thinking to myself, wow, this person is like serious and they're curious and like they're, you know what I mean? They're not being passive about this process. So yeah, that would be kind of, I guess, the biggest piece of advice I'd have.
So we could say like you developed or you perfectioned your social skills during your MBA and you expanded your network. Would you say that you've learned the technical skills during your undergrad or more just doing your job on the day-to-day basis?
I think technical skills are largely learned on the job, to be honest. Like, certainly, in academia, you can learn some theory, and don't get me wrong, there are some things I learned in the MBA program that I didn't learn on the job. Particularly in areas like finance and so on. But even then, like, you really kind of learn the nuances and the intricacies of these things when applying them in a real life context,
And are there any undergraduate courses you still found particularly useful for the job or?
God, that was so long ago now. I honestly can't remember from an undergrad perspective. But I would say at the MBA level, there were a couple courses that I still kind of tap into today. One being corporate finance, and just kind of understanding the basics of how enterprise valuation is done. and everything that goes into it, it becomes hugely important, certainly in our world in VC, but in a lot of applications, I think, very important. And then the other was, and again, this is more related to VC, but I had taken a course on M&A, and that was really interesting because we looked at a whole bunch of different M&A use cases, like case studies, ones that went really well, ones that didn't go so well, and why, and the different challenges related to M&A, including like post-merger integration and merging cultures between two organizations, things that often aren't always talked about. But then when you're actually dealing with that kind of stuff in a real life setting, you know, you're at the very least mindful of them enough to pay attention, you know, and hopefully avoid some of those mistakes. So anyway, those are two courses that I still remember to this day.
And what would you say are the most important skills on your day-to-day job?
Yeah, good question. One is networking, but I've elaborated already on that, so I'll move past that. The other skills I'd say are, I'd call this just having like a genuine curiosity around things. Like a big part of what we have to do is, so I'll give you an example. In my job, like at Panache Ventures, we look at companies across all industries. Okay. And so I'm not an expert on all industries. I know a little bit more about some because I worked in them, but like most industries are essentially new. I can kind of envision some of the things, like how they might work and things like that, but you don't really know. And so you get a pitch from a startup about something you've never heard about, and all of a sudden you have to determine, does this make sense or not? Like, do we spend more time on this? Like, do we pursue this further or not? And so part of the way to answer that question is like you have to like very quickly get smart on a particular topic. And so that obviously requires, you know, research, both secondary research, but also primary research and speaking to people, you know, again, in your network who might know something about this, and trying to get like gain as much insight as you can on a particular subject area so that when you're having a conversation with a founder, you can, again, leave a lasting impression and add some kind of value to that exchange. But it also allows you to better analyze and decipher what companies are doing and whether or not their roadmap makes sense and you believe in it and you want to fund it. So, yeah, that curiosity goes a long way in this job because there's a lot of having to kind of research and dig in and explore further to be able to answer some fundamental questions.
And you talked about the diversity of industries you invest in at Panache Ventures. How long do you think it typically takes you to be comfortable about one industry in particular to make an investment decision?
That's a great question. So as a sector agnostic fund, we see deal flow from across the country and like I said, across all sectors. So the amount of volume we have to go through is very high. We also make a number of investments per year. And in many cases, some of these fundraising rounds become highly competitive and they move very quick. So we don't always have the luxury of spending, you know, weeks and months diligencing a company as you would if you were doing an acquisition, for example, or if you're in private equity, because the market won't allow it, you know what I mean? And we just don't have the bandwidth to do that. Like most VC teams are fairly lean as well. Plus the other factor in this is that, you know, we invest in companies when they're at what's called the pre-seed or seed stage. So when they're extremely early, many times they're pre-revenue, sometimes they're even pre-product. And so really at that point, it's like, well, how much is there to diligence in the end? You know what I mean? So to answer your question, I mean, if we're really excited about something and a deal is moving super, super fast, it's happened where we've gone to conviction and we've pulled the trigger to make a deal in the matter of days. Otherwise, normally I would say our normal diligence cycle is, you know, 3-4 weeks for like a fundraising round that's active and moving. In cases where, but in a lot of cases, what we like to do is really meet founders very early on before they're even fundraising. That way we have more time to build a relationship with them, get to know what they're like, how they think, how they work, how they manage their teams, get to study that space over a longer period of time and gain more insight. And that helps arrive at a conclusion that has much more conviction behind it because we've had a bit more time to dig in.
You've mentioned that you sometime invest in pre-product or pre-revenue company. How do people pitch you a pre-product company?
They pitch you some grand idea that's going to make billions of dollars. And you have to sit there and sort of decide whether or not you believe them or whether they're, you know, full of it. Ultimately, in cases like that, when we're talking really early, like I said, there's not a ton to diligence, right? So what you end up paying attention to the most is, number one, the founder or founders, right? Like, that's the biggest thing that we actually can diligence is, like, who are they? How do they think? How do they work together? Like, what are their backgrounds? What kind of skills do they bring to the table? And ultimately, you're trying to answer questions like, why is this team uniquely positioned to win this market or to build a product in this space? You know, why do these specific co-founders work well together? You know, does this founder, do these founders have the mindset, the ambition, and, you know, the like resilience to build a billion-dollar company? And what that means in building a billion-dollar company is not just you have to be successful at building a company and the product has to go viral and, you know, all that stuff, right? And it also means that if things are going super well, right, and you're like on this hockey stick trajectory, at some point people are going to come knocking on the door and are going to try and buy you out, right? So someone's going to come and say, we will offer you $100 million for your company. And we expect those founders to say, no, thank you. We're not interested in selling right now. We're trying to build a $1 billion company. And there are very few people that actually think that way and that are as risk tolerant as that and as ambitious as that. So these are some of the things that we're trying to assess in those like early conversations with founders. The other big question we ask ourselves is around the market. That's the only other thing we can really look at, right? Is like, so, okay, especially if they're pre-product, it's like, okay, this is what they want to build, more or less. What is the problem that they're trying to solve, you know, in a particular industry? Is that really a big pain point? And for how many people is that a pain point? Like, how big of a market is how many people potentially can this actually serve if this works, you know? And if the answer to that question is a really, really big number, then that kind of checks the box, you know, that this has the potential to be a venture scale. Because if you look at all the companies that become unicorn companies, Uber, Airbnb, Facebook, they're all going after very broad markets, right? When you have companies that are trying to solve like a problem in a very niche space, it might work really well. They might have a very successful business on their hands, but it won't reach the kind of scale that we need to see the kind of returns we're looking for. As a general rule in venture capital, what you're trying to do is you're going to place a bunch of bets. And what's going to end up happening is that maybe one or two or three of those companies will stand out and will perform so much that they will pay for all the rest of the other investments that you made combined and more, you know, because all the others might fail. But it's the two or three that become, you know, $100 million companies and maybe a unicorn like billion dollar company that will return your funds investment. And that's what we're looking for. So the idea is that from the get-go, you should be, when you're evaluating a company, you should be trying to understand, like, does this even have that potential to begin with? Because if not, it's not worth it. Like, we have to be shooting for that number, because the likelihood is that they'll fall somewhere short of that. So if you shoot for a billion, maybe you'll land at 100 million. If you shoot for 100 million, you'll land at 30. And a $30 million exit is not a lot for most VCs.
And you mentioned both aspects you look for pre-product companies. Between the two, so between potential market and how the product solves an issue and the founder team, is there one of the two you find easier to more accurately evaluate?
I would say it's easier to evaluate the market, particularly if they're playing in an existing market, right? So that's the caveat. If they're playing in an industry that's well known, that's been around a long time, it's a little bit easier. There's data out there. We can quantify how big it is. We can do research and figure out how many competitors there are in the space, and therefore, like, what kind of market share do they need to hit in order to become the size of company we're looking for? And is that actually possible given the competitive dynamics in this space? It becomes like a little bit more of a quantitative exercise and one that's like a little bit more tangible. When it's an industry that is just forming and that is unknown, that's a lot harder, right? So for example, all this stuff around Gen AI right now is taking shape as we speak and evolving every day. It's a lot harder to like pin the tail on like a moving target, you know? But in terms of which one is the more important of the two, it's definitely the founder. Like, always emphasis harder on the founder. And in some cases, there's some deals that get done, you know, from us, but most VCs are like this, where, you know, whether or not you've gotten to conviction on the category they're building in or the product or what have you, sometimes there's something about the founder, and especially when you're investing so early, where you're like, you know what, I believe so much in this person that like, they will figure it out. You know what I mean? We're betting on them. You know, there's some kind of founder magic, as we call, and founder product fit are often the terms you'll hear thrown around, that exists, that is enough conviction to make an investment. Because ultimately what happens when you start off as a company that's pre-product, to get to become a unicorn, you will have probably had to pivot your business like several times along the way. And so ultimately the version of the product and vision of the company that you start out with doesn't matter as much as the quality of the founder, because you'll always bet on someone who is strong, that will be able to read the market, have their ear to the ground and ear to their customers, and will make those hard pivots along the way to grow the business.
What is a good time, you would say, to exit a company? What is your strategy? Are you looking for specific things?
When you say exit a company, you mean like for us to exit our position in
yes.
a business we've invested in? So for us, I mean, again, going back to sort of the economics of how VC work, you're placing these bets, and I choose that word bets not by accident, because essentially what happens is we are managing a fund of other people's money, right? And for those investors called LPs in the fund, those LPs, this investment in venture capital forms like a small percentage of their overall wealth portfolio that is supposed to represent the high risk, high reward asset, right? So most of the money in their portfolio is going towards, like, you know, blue chip stocks, bonds, maybe some real estate, things that are like a little bit more stable, right, and grow at a more steady pace. And then there's a small fraction of the portfolio that they put into like alternative assets, VC being one of them, that are more high risk, high reward. And so the expectation on us is to place bets on companies that have this like boomer bust profile, with the understanding being that a lot of them are going to go bust, right? So yes, there are opportunities along the way to like take secondaries or like cash out your position in a business, but a lot of VCs, including us, don't really exercise that option, because it's like you're betting on sports and you have like a parlay going and you get like four out of the five, you know, to win like this huge jackpot. And then the betting site is offering you like some small amount of money to cash out that like is a little bit more than what you put in, but like not the jackpot. It's like at that point, you might as well let the money ride and hope that you like win the big number. You know, it's a sort of the same concept in this way. It's just, it's understood. It's called the power law dynamic. And so you ultimately sort of let a lot of these investments ride. And some of them will go to zero. Some of them you'll get, you know, one for one your money back. Some of them you'll get a small exit. But you really, like, in a handful, you'll get, like, some big exits that will overcompensate all the rest.
And how would you say Panache Ventures differentiates from other VC firms, especially in Canada?
Great question. There's a few factors. So number one is we're really the only truly national pre-seed fund in Canada. First of all, the VC ecosystem in Canada is not so big. Okay, there's like a number of firms, and at early stage, especially, there's even fewer. But within them, like we have a coast-to-coast scope that most funds don't have. We also like to lead deals at pre-seed, which many funds won't do. By the way, leading deals, for those who don't know, means that you set the terms of the deal, like you set the valuation with the startup, and everyone else who participates in the fundraising round follows on to your terms. It also means as a result that you're probably doing the bulk of the diligence on the deal in order to set like to set those terms. And obviously there's then whether it's an expectation or just like an obvious benefit to, if you're leading a deal, like you're going to want to bring in other investors that you know and you trust, that you want on the cap table with you. And so you're making introductions and you're trying to help the company fill out the round. Not many investors are willing to do that at pre-seed because it's so early and it's so risky. So that's another way. The other thing too is that we have a team of ex-founders and ex-operators. Everyone from the partners down to the analysts on our team have some amount of startup experience in their background, either as a founder or as an employee. And that brings a lot of value because at the stage that we work with these companies, they're going through a whole bunch of like day-to-day tactical challenges that, you know, someone who, let's say, is working the same role but has like a finance background might be able to provide guidance at a more like strategic level when it comes to like, you know, how to allocate capital, things like that. But really that operational experience comes hugely handy and is a differentiator for us for sure. Lastly, we have a wealth of experience around fundraising and we really coach our startups to successfully raise subsequent rounds. We have an extremely strong track record of our companies going on to successfully raise Series A and B and so on. Part of the reason for that is, of course, picking strong companies from the beginning. But you know, a lot of it has to do, I think, with some of how we work with our startups in helping them navigate fundraising hurdles, coaching them on how to run a really tight fundraising process. And importantly, we have invested tremendously in building strong relationships with other investors, particularly in the US, where there is a much larger pool of capital. Part of the issue in Canada is that if you're a Canadian startup that's rising and need to raise Series A, B, C, there's often not enough money for you to be able to raise only in Canada. So all these companies inevitably have to go into the US. And we are one of the few firms who really have like a deep Rolodex of connections in the Bay Area and in New York City and the big markets to be able to make introductions to downstream investors for our companies.
What would you say is different between when you used to work at 37 Angel and now to Panache Ventures?
So, okay, two things. One is structurally, like a 37 Angels is not a VC fund per se. It's an angel network. So it's a group of angel investors, and there is a staff that basically will pre-vet deals. So they'll screen through all the companies, they'll meet with founders, the ones that are the most promising, they will do some preliminary diligence. And with some of the angels, particularly ones often who have like an expertise in that particular area, they will craft a diligence memo and circulate it to the larger group of angel investors to see who puts their hand up to want to invest in this company. Okay, that's different from how a VC fund works, where it is our team's job to make the decisions on behalf of the fund on who we invest. You know what I mean? So on the one hand, you are sort of pre-vetting and presenting like a select number of like pre-qualified companies that they can potentially invest in. And then it's up to them to decide whether to invest or not in those companies, the angels, versus a VC where like we have an investment committee who votes on and makes decisions on companies to invest in. So structurally, they're different in that sense. So that has implications on terms of like what the job is like in some ways and how much influence you can really have in terms of how you present deals and that sort of thing. The other difference I would say is around the US versus Canadian startup landscape. So 37Angels also invests in pre-seed and seed stage companies, also across a variety of sectors. So the thesis is similar. The difference is like the companies we're looking at were largely based in New York or let's say in the United States, whereas at Panache, we're looking at Canadian startups. And you sort of realize that there's like kind of like a DNA difference in the founders and how they've been kind of nurtured and trained to think over time. And this goes back to a whole bunch of things around like the cultural differences between Canadians and Americans. Shortly put, like the TLDR of this is just that like the American founders are often more ambitious, a little bit more direct, and will often be more polished and refined because there's a lot more competition even within their own city. You know what I mean? So even if you look at just New York, New York is big enough that even if you capture just the domestic market, that's already like you've built $1 million a year at least business. You know what I mean? If not more. We don't have that same kind of competitive density here. You know what I mean? That leads to that type of like urgency and ambition on the part of the founders. Plus, I think as Canadians, we're taught, you know, to be nice and polite and not be so direct and ask what you want and that sort of thing. You see that kind of come through in a lot of conversations.
And moving on, are there any industries you personally prefer to invest in?
Personally, I'm a guy who's generally curious about everything. So that's one of the reasons I love this job is because I get to learn about new things, new areas, new industries that I had no idea about, like on a regular basis. At the moment, I find myself particularly intrigued by everything that's happening in the climate tech space in particular. Obviously, everything going on in AI is hugely interesting. And so the intersection of the two, I think, forms like an interesting kind of Venn diagram area that is one worth paying attention to.
And do you have one specific company that you find really promising?
We meet interesting companies all the time and we invest in really interesting things. So one of the companies we invested in last year, based out of Montreal, they're a group of PhD students from the Mila Institute in Montreal, which is a big kind of AI program headed by Joshua Bengio, who is, some people might know, is very increasingly famous guy. He just made the Time 100 most influential list I saw last week. Anyhow, very world-renowned AI institute based here in our own backyard in Montreal. We invested in these guys because they were building a leading class of methods called Generative Flow Networks that is used in building like protein folding algorithms for the discovery of new drugs. And the claim, and they're basically proving that right now with their most recent like case studies and white papers, is that they are like have data sets, they can create possible data sets hundreds of times larger than the current industry standard, which is Google's AlphaFold model. And as a result, in theory, it means that they will be able to find like novel proteins for different types of cancer treatments and things of that nature. So hugely promising. It's a very technical team, in a very complex space, but potentially with like transformational potential.
Great. And now moving on to our mentorship segment, what would you recommend to a student?
I should add, if anyone's interested, the company is called Dreamfold AI.
Great. And yeah, so what would you recommend to any student who wants to break into a venture capital?
The advice I often give is that if you want to break into venture capital, don't try breaking into venture capital. Go work in startups for a while. Either start one yourself with some friends, learn what it's like to try and build a business from scratch, or go work at a very early startup. And in whatever role, whether it's, you know, depending what you're interested in, what you do, whether you're a developer, whether you're a product person, whether you're a marketing person, sales, you know, what have you, operations, any of that startup experience is hugely valuable and will make your candidacy much more appealing to a VC once comes the time, if you're still interested in pursuing that route. It'll become much more interesting. You'll be able to add a lot more value having operational experience, as I mentioned earlier.
And are there any characteristics of these startups that students should look for when choosing one to work at?
I mean, it's a subjective question, right? It depends on what it is that you want to get out of that experience. I think in many ways, diligencing a potential employer, like a company to go work for, or a startup to go work for, is similar to diligencing a startup you want to invest in. It's, you know, what is this industry? Like, what are they doing? Is it interesting? Does it make sense? Do I think this company has legs, or will it die tomorrow? You know what I mean? Because you don't want to go work at a company that's, you know, where you're going to lose your job in a few months. Critically important, like, what are the founders like? You know, do I believe in them? Like, what is their vision, and can I get behind that? What is the culture like in that organization so far? You know, what kind of trajectory are they on at the moment, and is it promising? You know, and then there's some specific things around, depending on how far along they are and what size the company is at and what role you're trying to apply to. It's like, okay, well, where do I fit in this organization? Is there opportunity for me to grow within this organization? You know what I mean? Sometimes you might decide to go work for a company that's a bit more of a risk, but that's earlier on, so that you get in earlier and then you have a chance to grow with the business, than like going and work for a startup that's more well established and then you kind of slot in somewhere in the middle there, you know, that kind of thing. It all depends, but I get, like, these are all personal questions, but it's many of the same questions we ask ourselves, you know, when trying to evaluate the startup.
And if you had to start again and you knew you wanted to go into venture capital, what would be your choice of undergrad?
I don't know that the undergrad matters all that much, to be honest, like with respect to this, like ending up here. Part of me wishes that I would have learned at some point how to code, and like on a more technical level, like how developers work and what, you know, what coding languages are out there, what, like, understand like all like the more technical aspects of building a product. I've had some amount of exposure to that, like just being deeply entrenched in some of the dev projects that I oversaw when I was at CN, but it's not the same, you know what I mean? And so Yeah, I guess that's one thing. Maybe I would have done something in computer science or something like that.
How do you think students should go about finding an internship?
Generally speaking, I think regardless of where you're trying to find an internship, first off, I think you need to have some really real conversations with yourself around like, okay, what are you hoping to achieve? Right? It's very easy to be like, I want to go work at like McKinsey because they have like a brand name, to go on the resume. And there's nothing wrong with that. That has its value. But, I think particularly when it comes to an internship, like it's a question of how much learning can you get out of it? How much networking opportunity can you get out of it? I think those are like the two sort of criteria that should be at the top of everyone's mind when thinking through like where they want to do their internship. How to go about it, I think, is really comes down to networking once again, right? So once you've answered that question and you say, okay, like here's what I'm hoping to get out of it as a result. These are the type, like, so it's what do you want to get out of it? What are the areas I'm interested in? In that Venn diagram, you will research and find a list of companies and places that you think would be a good fit. Some of them will be looking to hire interns, and so now you have to reach out. The best way to do that is again through your network. Just like in BC, like someone reaches out to me cold via email. Oftentimes I'll end up ignoring it. It's just the reality of like how much volume there is to deal with, and it's a question of time. And I'm sure most executives and hiring managers and companies, it's the same. What's much more effective is being referred by someone that they know and that they trust. So often part of networking is just understanding like it's not just who are you connected to, but it's also who are those people connected to, and seeing if you can. That's how you start leveraging the network, is like, can someone you know make an introduction for you to the place that you want to be? So to the extent that you can do that, that often kind of puts you at the top of the CV pile.
So talking about internships, are there any opportunities at Panache Ventures?
At the moment, we haven't actually made any decisions on whether or not we're looking to hire interns this year. Some years we have, some years we haven't. But nevertheless, like we're always interested in meeting, interesting people. So, don't be shy to reach out.
We'll move on to the rapid fire questions. But before that, do you have anything else you wanted to add or to say to the students or to people who listen to our podcast?
Yeah, one thing, like one reflection I've had since I've graduated is, and it goes back to this idea of like, when I was in the MBA program, they kind of pushed the consulting piece hard and these sort of corporate roles hard. I found, if I'm being truly honest, that like there was not enough emphasis and attention placed on entrepreneurship and the startup world as being a possible or viable career path for people. And I don't know if that's still the case. I've been out of school for a few years now, so maybe that's changed. But what I would say to students out there listening is, don't just pay attention to like what you're learning in class. Like go out and do your own research, find your own passions, and don't be afraid to explore those opportunities as well. There's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in the tech world. That may or may not be talked about at school, and read up about it, learn about it. You might find that there's actually a better fit, culturally, with your interests, with your skill sets, in a place like that than some of the other environments and companies that will come knocking and recruiting and will be present at the career fairs and all that kind of stuff. So just keep that in mind.
So moving on to our rapid fire question segment. So these are questions that can be answered either with a few words or a few sentences only. The first one is, what is the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you?
Oof. Work is just work at the end of the day. It'll always be there, and there's more important things in life.
How would you describe your career in one word?
non-linear. It's two words, but.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how important would you say your GPA is as a student?
Zero.
If you weren't working in venture capital, what would you be doing instead?
Probably trying to start a business myself. That's still a goal I have for myself at some point one day.
And what is one book you would recommend to our listeners?
Ooh. I'm actually reading a book right now that I'm really enjoying. It's called The New Map. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning book. It basically examines like the shifting geopolitics that are happening as a result of the energy crisis and climate change. And so it does a really good job of looking through the like economic and historical history of America, Russia, China, and the Middle East through like how like of their energy industries and energy dependencies. And then at the end, it culminates with like, well, what does this mean for where we are today and what does the future look like? Really well-researched and very fascinating book, I highly recommend.
Very interesting. This is the end of the episode. I'm sure your knowledge and everything you shared with us today is going to be very valuable to our listeners. And thanks again for being here today.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me. And if anyone has questions or wants to reach out, they can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to connect.
Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the episode. If you enjoyed the show, don't hesitate to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Take care and see you next time.
The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform our listeners. It is by no means a substitute for professional guidance by qualified experts. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute financial or other professional advice or services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your career options, as well as financial undertakings with other professionals who specialize in wealth, securities, and asset management, or any other field in financial services. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at a personal and individual risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Guests who speak on this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. The views expressed on this platform are personal opinions and only, and should not be construed as financial advice for a given situation or from a given institution. While all attempts are made to present accurate information, it may not be appropriate for specific circumstances, and information may become outdated over time. No firm, nor any company providing financial support, endorses or opposes any particular view or tools discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising, which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. This podcast may not be edited, modified, or redistributed. The Corporate Chat Podcast has no liability for any personal activities in connection with this podcast or for personal use of this podcast in connection with personal websites, computers, or playing devices. Moreover, the Corporate Chat Podcast makes no warranty that this podcast or the server that makes it available is free of viruses, worms, or other elements or codes that manifest contaminating or destructive properties. McGill University and our sponsors expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, reliance on, or inability to use this podcast or the information presented in this podcast.